As all eyes on the Middle East remain fixated on the war between Iran and the United States and Israel, the stage is quietly being set behind the scenes for the next great era of conflict in the region that over the long run will be far more consequential than this current war, and which will determine the course of Middle Eastern history for the next decade to come. The emerging Cold War between the Arab world's two greatest and wealthiest powers, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. In many ways, the evidence of this newly emerging Cold War between them is already visibly apparent. In late December of 2025, Saudi warplanes directly bombed a UAE weapons shipment in Yemen that was bound for UAE-backed separatists in the country, while Saudi and Emirati-backed forces in the country openly battled against each other on the ground. Vicious insults were hurled at each other across social media, with Emiratis accusing the Saudis of bullying their smaller neighbor and supporting political Islam, and the Saudis blasting the Emiratis as being anti-Islamic, too pro-Israel, and fueling chaos across the Middle East by supporting separatists. But the emerging Cold War between them extends far beyond Yemen across the greater Middle East and surrounding regions. They support radically different sides in the brutal ongoing civil war in Sudan that is fueling one of the world's deadliest genocides. They support different sides in the looming war in the Horn of Africa, with the UAE backing Abiy Ahmed's government in Ethiopia and the breakaway state of Somaliland, and Saudi Arabia backing the Eritrean and Somalian governments instead. They dramatically diverge on their position relating to Israel, with the UAE recognizing and allying with Israel despite the unresolved Palestinian issue, and Saudi Arabia refusing to do so. They are increasingly bitter economic rivals, with Saudi Arabia's goals to diversify away from oil into the tourism, airline, finance, and AI sectors, directly encroaching on the UAE's regional leads in these industries that they achieved during their own drive to diversify away from oil earlier. And while they used to work together under the logic of a more threatening mutual enemy in the form of the Islamic Republic of Iran that challenged them both, that historic logic is eroding away the weaker that Iran becomes through its punishing wars with Israel and the United States. With their historical mutual enemy becoming increasingly removed from the board in the Middle East, the otherwise natural rivalry between Saudi Arabia and the UAE that has festered just beneath the surface for years is increasingly erupting out into the open, and it will shortly become the dominant geopolitical force that drives whatever happens in the Middle East next for the following decade. And all of this may come as rather surprising to you, since just last decade across the 2010s, Saudi Arabia and the UAE maintained closely aligned foreign policies with one another and were generally seen as solid, reliable allies. Both countries were wary of the staunchly anti-monarchist Islamic Revolution in Iran's threats to their monarchies, and viewed Iran's support for proxies across the Middle East as their shared top existential threat, followed by the pro-democracy and Sunni anti-monarchist movements that swept across the region during and after the Arab Spring movement as well. The royal families in both countries were primarily concerned about maintaining their positions of power and the status quo against these external anti-monarchist threats across the 2010s. Both sought the protection of the United States to defend them against these threats, and they did not yet see each other as direct competitors. Much of their friendliness during this earlier era was also built upon the personally cordial relationship between their de facto leaders, Mohammed bin Zayed, or MBZ, in the UAE, and Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, in Saudi Arabia. By the circumstances of geography, the UAE found itself in the unenviable position of being a much smaller country wedged in between two larger giants, Iran and Saudi Arabia. After MBZ rose to power in the UAE in 2014, he began pursuing an aggressive foreign policy that was determined to elevate his country's relative position, and which prioritized building a coalition with the Saudis against the Iranians after he had adeptly identified that the Saudi kingdom was at that very moment in the midst of a succession crisis that his smaller nation had a once-in-a-generation opportunity to influence and benefit from. By that point, Saudi Arabia had been continually ruled by the many aging children of the kingdom's original founder, Ibn Saud, for the past 60-plus years. In 2015, Ibn Saud's 25th son, Salman, became king at the youthful age of 79, which directly led to an internal power struggle amongst the younger members of the Saudi royal family to become the true power standing behind the throne. Early on in this power struggle, MBZ identified a young and ambitious MBS as his favored candidate and began providing his support and backing, hyping him up through lobbying to the Americans, the Saudis, and other Westerners and solidifying his credibility in the process. The hard work ultimately paid off, and despite MBS only being King Salman's seventh son, MBS was appointed as Saudi Arabia's defense minister in early 2015 at the age of just 29 years old. And a few months later, he was appointed as deputy crown prince, positioning him to control the levers of power in the country thanks to the direct intervention of MBZ and the UAE. And with that, the UAE was able to utilize the far more powerful Saudi Arabia as effectively a force multiplier of their own ambitions. For years afterwards, the personal relationship between MBZ and MBS blossomed. At 24 years his senior, MBZ reportedly saw a younger version of himself in MBS. A man willing to take risks. Someone who understood the radical transformations that were necessary for their countries to survive in a post-oil future. And most importantly of all, a man willing to get his hands dirty to do what was necessary for survival. A sort of mentor-mentee relationship is reported to have developed between them, and the two men pursued closely aligned aggressive foreign policies against their shared enemies and in support of their shared allies and backers. Saudi Arabia, which had been effectively a sleeping giant ruled by cautious old men for generations, suddenly transformed into a revisionist power like the UAE was, under their much younger, new, ambitious leadership. MBS and MBZ sent troops together into Yemen in 2015 to intervene against the Iranian-backed Houthis in the country. And then both men led their countries into the blockade of their neighbor Qatar in 2017, in an attempt to pressure them into distancing from Iran, shutting down Al Jazeera, and ending their alleged support for the Muslim Brotherhood, a transnational Sunni Islamist faction that advocates for a form of political Islam that's generally deemed to be anti-monarchist, and therefore deemed a threat to the Emirati and Saudi royal families. MBS also boldly ordered the kidnapping of Lebanon's prime minister in 2017 and referred to Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei as the new Hitler. But then, starting in 2018, the first signs of divergence between Saudi Arabia and the UAE and between MBS and MBZ personally began emerging that would eventually build up into their current full-on Cold War. The war in Yemen against the Iranian-backed Houthis had transformed into a visible quagmire for the Saudis. The deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in Yemen being caused by Saudi Arabia's intervention using American-made weapons generated substantial international criticism, which culminated with the Biden administration suspending U.S. sales of offensive weapons to the Saudis almost immediately after Biden took office in January of 2021. Meanwhile, Houthi missiles and drones began bombing Saudi cities and critical oil infrastructure back in retaliation. The first time that Saudi territory was directly attacked by a foreign power since Saddam did so back during the 1991 Gulf War. While Riyadh and Abu Dhabi's objectives in Yemen also gradually diverged apart from each other. Saudi Arabia grew primarily focused on maintaining security along their borders with Yemen, stopping the Houthi drone and missile attacks on their cities, ending the damage being done to their international reputation by the war, and keeping Iranian influence at bay. And they came to see that the best way of doing that was by reunifying Yemen under an internationally recognized central government, where all sides, including the Houthis, shared in power. Meanwhile, the UAE, who was being attacked far less frequently by the Houthis and who was also suffering far less political fallout from the intervention, decided to consolidate their expanding influence in Yemen by backing the separatist STC faction, who wanted to secede and recreate the former state of South Yemen, and in the process, secure their influence over the critical Bab el-Mandeb Strait at the southern end of the Red Sea. As a result, the UAE ended up securing its influence over a separatist southern state in Yemen, while the Saudis largely got left behind holding the bag, bogged down in an unwinnable and politically ruinous war in the north against the Houthis. And then, of course, came the killing and dismemberment of the Washington Post's columnist Jamal Khashoggi within the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018, which the CIA quickly concluded had been personally ordered by MBS himself. All of these aggressive actions and controversies turned MBS into something of a pariah in the Western world, which dramatically impacted Saudi Arabia's ability to attract the foreign investors and capital that they needed to diversify away from oil into other industries like tourism and finance, to say nothing of the Houthi missiles and drones that were sometimes bombarding Saudi cities. Perhaps most symbolically of all, in March of 2022, Houthi missiles and drones slammed into a Saudi oil depot and blew it up on the outskirts of the city of Jeddah, just 11 kilometers away from where the Formula One Saudi Grand Prix was actively being hosted at the time. leading to black smoke being visible from the attack directly from the circuit, and probably no doubt influencing drivers, fans, and worst of all, investors' willingness to consider returning again. All of this meant that by 2021 and 2022, MBS and Saudi Arabia decided to abandon their previously aggressive foreign policy that had worked in tandem with the UAE since 2015, but it generated for them significant instability and blowback, and they reverted back to focusing on building up stability, calm, and predictability at home instead to create the environment that they needed to attract all the foreign investment that they required for their Vision 2030 program. MBS's grand idea to diversify the Saudi kingdom away from oil into the tourism, airline, business, and finance industries. A vision that would never be successful, with investors fearful of parking their money in projects in a country where they could realistically get blown up in smoke. This shift away from the more aggressive policies of the 2010s meant burying the hatchet and improving their relations with their enemies. Saudi Arabia ended their failed blockade of Qatar in 2021 after having achieved zero of their objectives there. Qatar maintained relations with Iran, never shut down Al Jazeera, and continued financing Islamist groups across the region. After Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, the West sheepishly ended MBS's pariah status by welcoming it back into the fold in order to maintain access to the Saudi oil fields. In 2023, China helped mediate a restoration in relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran, while the Saudis also worked hard to reconcile their relations with Turkey as well. They stopped their airstrikes in Yemen completely, abandoned their campaign to permanently remove the Houthis there, and began lobbying for all sides in the war to de-escalate and to form a unity government in Yemen under a power-sharing agreement instead. Whatever it took to stop the Houthis from shooting back at them. Meanwhile, without yet suffering any substantial blowback themselves and with an economy that was already highly diversified away from oil, the UAE, under the leadership of MBZ, has basically just continued maintaining their same aggressive foreign policy from the 2010s into the 2020s against their perceived threats and to project geopolitical power opportunistically, which has increasingly come to be viewed as running against Saudi Arabia's current interests by MBS. Unlike the Saudis, who began trying to keep countries in the region together in the 2020s in the name of stability, the Emiratis, more often than not, came to support an increasingly large array of separatists in their drive to expand their own influence. In addition to carving out their influence in South Yemen with the Southern Separatist Project, the Emiratis also began backing the Somaliland Secessionist Project on the other side of the Red Sea in Somalia, developing a new port there at Berbera and quietly accepting Somaliland passports, effectively recognizing Somaliland's independence in everything but name. Further up the Red Sea in Sudan after the civil war exploded there in 2023, Saudi Arabia and Egypt backed the military government and the Sudanese armed forces, while the UAE immediately backed the rebel rapid support forces instead because they viewed the government as having too many political Islamists from the old Omar al-Bashir regime who were still within their ranks. In Libya, they began supporting the authoritarian Generalissimo Khalifa Haftar in the east, against the more Islamist government in the west that was backed by Qatar and Turkey. While in Syria, following the rise to power of Ahmed al-Shara, a former al-Qaeda-affiliated jihadist, the Saudis offered billions of dollars worth of capital for reconstruction, while the UAE has offered up very little because of their skepticism over al-Shara's jihadist past. In all of these countries, the Saudis began pursuing a pragmatic foreign policy in the 2020s that has been willing to work together with their ideological enemies, like political Islamists, in exchange for stability and calm, keeping conflicts contained and countries together, while the Emiratis have continued a policy of expanding their influence and power and crushing political Islamists abroad wherever they can find them, by fueling more secular separatists across the region in Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, and Libya. Especially if they could provide the Emiratis access to ports and resources that their central governments weren't willing or able to provide themselves. And the Saudis reconciled with their old enemies like Iran, Qatar, and Turkey, while the Emiratis maintained their confrontational posture towards them. Thus, as the 2020s have progressed, the Saudis have come to change their view on the UAE from a major ally with shared enemies and goals to a major source of destabilization in the Middle East that is posing a significant threat to the goals of their Vision 2030 economic diversification strategy. Yemen and Sudan in particular are festering wounds of chaos nearby to Saudi Arabia that have substantial risks of geopolitical spillover that the Saudis would very much like to stabilize no matter who ends up in power there. While the Emiratis remain more picky and would like to see non-Islamists in power and, barring that, they'd rather see outright state collapse or cleave off secessionist projects that are more secular and more amenable to them. As opposed to the ideological conflict that drove the Middle East's Cold War in the 2010s between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the emerging Cold War between Saudi Arabia and the UAE in the 2020s is primarily economic in nature. Right now, nearly half of the Saudi economy is still dependent on oil, while the UAE only relies on oil for about 25% of its own economy. In order to diversify further away from oil to secure their future, the Saudis are rapidly investing into alternative industries that the Emiratis have long dominated in their region. Saudi tourism megaprojects like NEOM, The Line, and the Red Sea Project are all designed to transform the Saudi kingdom into a global luxury tourism hotspot, which traditionally has been dominated in the Middle East by the UAE. The Saudis' creation of Riyadh Air in 2023 and their multi-billion dollar Riyadh Airport expansion is specifically intended to challenge the regional airline dominance of UAE-based carriers like Emirates and Etihad. And the Saudis' declaration in 2022 that government contracts would henceforth only be given to foreign firms who relocated their regional headquarters to Saudi territory was an obvious and direct challenge to Dubai, which for decades has been the epicenter of foreign business operations in the Middle East. In other words, Saudi Arabia is attempting to directly challenge the UAE's current regional dominance in business headquarters, finance, and tourism, while they're also trying to challenge Dubai and Abu Dhabi's positions as the most significant air and logistics links between Asia, Europe, and Africa, with Riyadh and Jeddah as alternatives. Saudi Arabia needs to succeed here in order to guarantee their post-oil future. But to do so means crowding out the UAE and their own already successful diversification away from oil strategy in the process. And the UAE is absolutely determined to never allow that to happen, lest they lose out on their own post-oil future. The Emirati leadership, after all, is well aware that Saudi Arabia is currently threatening to do to them what they themselves had previously done to Bahrain several decades ago. It's hard to imagine this today, but for most of the 20th century, it was actually Bahrain who was the major economic powerhouse in the Persian Gulf. The small island kingdom was the first in the region to discover oil in the early 1930s, which they were able to utilize to gain an economic head start over everyone else. Bahrain astutely invested their oil money to diversify their economy away from oil into different sectors like tourism and finance. And by the 1970s, Bahrain was the undisputed financial center of the Gulf. But then, beginning in the early 1990s, the UAE began increasingly challenging Bahrain's decades of dominance. They established finance centers in Dubai with less regulations and more capital and began building ambitious, world-famous, headline-grabbing megaprojects that cemented the UAE's location on the map as a luxury tourism hotspot. Places like the Burj Al Arab, the world's first seven-star hotel, the Palm Jumeirah and other reclaimed islands, and the Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest building. By the middle of the 1990s, and certainly by the early 2000s, the UAE had managed to use this strategy to eclipse Bahrain in virtually every sector of the economy, from finance to tourism. And now, the Saudis are adopting these exact same strategies today that the Emiratis had used against Bahrain 30 years ago. While they're also increasingly competing in another new major potential source of diversification away from oil too, the realm of artificial intelligence, or AI. Both countries in the 2020s have come to view AI as a possible guarantee of their post-oil futures. They know how important the AI race is this decade between the US and China. And they know that if they can manage to lock in an indispensable position within the AI supply chain to the Americans, they can also secure a firm American commitment to defending their national security in an increasingly uncertain world. Basically, pulling off something similar to what Taiwan managed to do in the semiconductor supply chain by guaranteeing U.S. military support through carving out an indispensable niche to them in the semiconductor manufacturing process. Both governments have already pledged tens of billions of dollars into AI-related investments just since 2024, including through some pretty sketchy Saudi deals with the Americans. Most notably, the Wall Street Journal recently reported that just 4 days before Donald Trump's inauguration in January of 2026, the UAE government quietly agreed to purchase a 49% stake in the Trump family's then-struggling cryptocurrency company that had no active products, called World Liberty Financial, for $500 million, $187 million of which directly flowed to entities under the Trump family's personal ownership, marking the first time in U.S. history that a foreign government purchased a major ownership stake in an incoming president's company. Then, curiously, just a couple of months later, the new Trump administration agreed to allow the UAE to import 500,000 of NVIDIA's most powerful AI chips to build one of the world's largest AI data center clusters, ignoring all of the intelligence community's previous fears that doing so would allow the UAE to pass on NVIDIA's critical technology to China. The hope of the UAE, no doubt, is to try and hook themselves to America's emerging AI industry as much as possible over the Saudis through any means necessary, including through exploiting what seems to be a pretty open case of corruption within the current American government. If they are successful, then they can guarantee America's military support in an uncertain future the same kind of way that Taiwan has, while the Saudis are pushing ahead for their own AI industry for the exact same reasons. Perhaps the biggest point of divergence between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, however, have been their radically different approaches towards Israel. Historically, both countries, along with most of the rest of the Arab and Muslim worlds, refused to normalize their relations with Israel without a solution to the Palestinian question that resulted in a fully independent Palestinian state. But then, in 2020, the UAE suddenly decided to abandon this long, unified approach and fully normalize their own relations with Israel, without any solution to the question of Palestinian statehood, undermining the Saudis' own position. Afterwards, the UAE was able to successfully mediate for Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, normalizing their relations with Israel as well. Pushing even further forward, the Emiratis rapidly increased their security cooperation and intelligence sharing with Israel in a relationship that increasingly became more than just simple recognition, but a full-blown alliance. By 2021, the UAE and Israel were conducting joint naval exercises together in the Red Sea, and allegedly even developed a joint listening post together on the Yemeni islands of Socotra and Perim in order to maintain surveillance operations on the Houthis. Meanwhile, the value of trade between Israel and the UAE grew exponentially from only a couple $100 million a year in 2020 to more than $3 billion a year by 2023. For a few years there, the Israelis believed that the UAE were going to help deliver them the greatest prize of all: normalization with Saudi Arabia without giving the Palestinians an independent state. Indeed, by September of 2023, MBS himself exclaimed during an interview on Fox News that they were merely weeks away from finalizing such a deal. But then instead, a few weeks passed by and Hamas launched their attack on Israel on October 7th. Kick-starting the series of wars that have rocked the Middle East ever since, that have pushed the Israelis and Saudis even further apart, and the Israelis and Emiratis even closer together. Israel almost overnight shifted from a status quo power in the Middle East to a revisionist power, fitting more in line with the UAE's historically aggressive foreign policy posture. The Israelis flattened Gaza and defanged Hamas, escalated their operations across the West Bank, bombarded Lebanon from the air and launched a ground invasion that decapitated Hezbollah's leadership, repeatedly bombed Syria, destroying the country's air defenses and contributing to the Assad regime's collapse, before launching another ground invasion near the Golan Heights, repeatedly bombed the Houthis in Yemen, and have launched repeated waves of massive airstrikes directly against Iran in cooperation with the Americans, which has resulted in even more blowback the Saudis didn't ask for, with Iranian drones and missiles now being fired directly at critical Saudi oil infrastructure. And nearly all of these Israeli attacks were also waged against the UAE's own regional political Islamist enemies as well. In Syria, Israel and the UAE both came to support the secessionist Druze faction that emerged in the south of the country. Then in early 2026 in Somalia, Israel chose to go even further than the UAE had ever done and became the first UN member state to formally recognize Somaliland's independence there, widely viewed as a move by the Israelis to establish a permanent military presence in Somaliland to maintain a force more closely located to the Houthis. and a deal that was likely mediated by the UAE in order to gain Israel's support for their port development project at Berbera. Shortly before this, MBS was personally visiting with U.S. President Donald Trump in Washington at the tail end of 2025, where he allegedly requested that the U.S. begin sanctioning the UAE over the Emirati support of the RSF in Sudan, who had just perpetrated a massacre of potentially tens of thousands of sub-Saharan African people in a matter of days in the city of El Fasher in Darfur, and who the U.S. government has also formally recognized as being guilty of committing genocide in Darfur. Possibly in retaliation for this, the UAE then seemingly gave their backed STC separatist faction in Yemen the green light to launch a new offensive against the Saudi-backed unity government in the country. Their surprise offensive rapidly overran the Saudi-backed side's positions across the east of Yemen, which led the STC to threaten a formal declaration of independence and to subsequently recognize Israel as an independent state in a broader geopolitical coordination with the UAE. But Saudi Arabia decided to immediately respond by bombing Emirati weapons shipments that were going to the STC directly, and then backed their own side's counteroffensive with direct air support against the STC that rapidly reversed all of the STC's gains, and then resulted in their complete collapse. And in the process, also resulting in the complete collapse of the UAE's presence and influence in Yemen as well. After Israel recognized Somaliland's independence with the obvious mediation of the UAE behind the scenes, Somalia retaliated with fury by severing all of their diplomatic relations with the UAE, expelling the UAE military from the country, and canceling all of their previous financial contracts with the UAE as well. Somalia even went so far as to call for the Saudis to lead a military intervention into the country to help restore the government's lost authority over Somaliland, something which the Saudis, so far, have been reluctant to do, unlike in Yemen. And most alarmingly of all to the Saudis, the Israelis were even bold enough to conduct an airstrike in Doha, the capital city of Qatar, which targeted Hamas's leadership who were being housed in a Qatari government residential complex. That Israeli attack on the territory of Qatar particularly shocked the Saudi leadership, because it showed that if the Israelis were willing to bomb the territory of Qatar, a major non-NATO ally of the United States, who also hosts America's biggest military base in the Middle East, they were probably willing to bomb the territory of just about anyone else too, including Saudi Arabia. So, while Saudi Arabia historically viewed the Iranians as the largest source of destabilization in the Middle East, and the biggest threat to the stability they required for the Vision 2030 diversification away from oil program, they have increasingly come to view Israel and the UAE as being the biggest threats to that stability instead now. With Israel and the UAE pretty much supporting all of the same separatist factions in Syria, Yemen, and Somalia that threaten to tear those states apart, Israel directly bombing multiple countries from Lebanon to Syria to Yemen to Iran and even to Qatar, and with the UAE fueling the civil war in Sudan through their support of the RSF and their attempt to shear off southern Yemen, Saudi Arabia also now deeply fears strategic encirclement by this new Israel-UAE axis, and fears that together, the Israelis and the Emiratis are openly pushing towards full-blown Middle Eastern hegemony under their own terms that could directly challenge Saudi Arabia's capability to successfully diversify away from oil. Moreover, Saudi Arabia's capability and willingness to recognize Israel and join them has become effectively impossible in the post-October 7th world. Israel's obliteration of Gaza and its genocidal retaliation against the Palestinians there has nosedived the public opinion of Israel all across the Arab and Muslim worlds. A poll from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy in August of 2023 found that 43% of Saudi Arabia's citizens, at that point before the war had started, supported normalizing business and economic ties with the Israelis. But by December of 2023, just a few months later, after the war had started, that ratio had already plummeted to just 17% instead, while an overwhelming 96% of Saudi respondents said that Arab countries should immediately sever all of their relations with Israel. MBS knows that with numbers like that at home, there is no conceivable way that he can ever lead Saudi Arabia into recognizing Israel without generating an existential internal crisis so severe that it could threaten his own regime and possibly even his own life. The UAE has been able to maintain the relationship with Israel largely because they have such a dramatically smaller population. about 90% of the UAE's population are foreigners these days, and there's only a little over 1 million actual Emirati citizens. By contrast, only about 43% of Saudi Arabia's population are foreigners, and they have about 20 million Saudi citizens' opinions to actually worry about, a substantial number of whom also follow the much more hardline Wahhabi school of Sunni Islam. The UAE has a far, far smaller population of their own citizens who they must fear by cooperating with Israel, while Saudi Arabia, with their control of the two holiest sites in Islam in Mecca and Medina, must also take worldwide Muslim opinion into account with their foreign policy decisions that the UAE simply doesn't experience. Moreover, the Saudis have also basically gotten everything they would have wanted out of recognizing Israel without actually having to do it anyway. During MBS's most recent visit to the White House in 2025, when he allegedly asked for American sanctions on the UAE over what's going on in Sudan, he also managed to secure the Trump administration's elevation of Saudi Arabia to major non-NATO ally status, the sale of the F-35 fighter jet to his kingdom, and American technological assistance with a civilian nuclear power program. Basically, all of the things that the previous Biden administration had been dangling in front of Saudi Arabia as the carrots they'd give for recognizing Israel. Now that Trump gave them all of the carrots without them having to recognize Israel, on top of the higher reputational and instability costs that they'd pay for recognizing Israel now after Gaza's destruction, why on earth would the Saudis ever actually do so? They're simply not going to do it, and there's basically nothing that can be done to make them do it now, which is only further fueling the divergence taking place between Saudi Arabia and the UAE. There are effectively two different webs of alliances in the Middle East and the periphery that are forming right now, one being led by Saudi Arabia and the other being led by the UAE and Israel. Shortly after the Israeli airstrike on Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan agreed to sign an unprecedented mutual defense pact that's similar to NATO, pledging each other to the other's military defense if they are attacked by someone else, and which might also, at least in theory, place Saudi Arabia under Pakistan's nuclear weapons umbrella. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan have also both recently confirmed that they are actively in discussions to add Turkey into this mutual defense pact as well, who have their own concerns about the ascendance of Israel and the UAE in the region, in an emerging defense pact that some analysts are calling the Islamic NATO. Qatar, long a promoter of political Islam and a key ally of Erdogan's Turkey in that project, is also going to be a presumable member of the Saudi-led camp now, along with El-Sisi's Egypt, largely due to the UAE support of the RSF in Sudan, and their support of Abiy Ahmed's Ethiopia and his mega dam on the Nile that threatens their water source. On the other side are the UAE and Israel, along with other Muslim countries who have joined the Abraham Accords and recognized Israel, like Bahrain and Morocco, and other peripheral non-Muslim countries like Cyprus, Greece, and India. Greece and Cyprus largely over their conflict with Turkey that aligns with Israel now, and India over their eternal conflict with Pakistan and their outrage at the Pakistan-Saudi Mutual Defense Pact. Between them are a variety of battleground states in which they are all increasingly competing for influence, with the Saudi-led side largely supporting central governments trying to keep the country's recognized borders together, and the UAE-Israel side largely supporting separatists or militias fighting against those central governments, trying to tear the countries apart, from Syria to Yemen to Somalia to Sudan. Without the glue of their greater mutual Iranian enemy holding them together any longer, this new emerging rivalry across the Middle East is what will inevitably rush in to fill the vacuum. For the United States and Israel, they may very well be successful at toppling the Iranian regime during this latest war, or at least severely degrade Iran's power projection capabilities. But in the process, it will give rise to this new problem for both of them to manage, and Washington's core strategic challenge in the Middle East will inevitably shift from containing Iran to containing this new Saudi-Emirati-Israeli rivalry instead. If left unchecked for too long, the United States might eventually have to take a firm side between the UAE and Saudi Arabia if the rivalry between them becomes truly irreconcilable. And that could become an impossibly difficult choice to make between Saudi Arabia's oil might and religious legitimacy, Qatar's LNG might and its hosting of the largest U.S. military base in the region, and Turkey's invaluable position in NATO, and the UAE's increasing influence over the AI industry and their economic might, and America's historically close relationship to Israel. Meanwhile, in the United States, One of the most concerning things about living here is that there are pretty weak data privacy laws and a ton of personal data that gets put out into the public record, frequently by local, state, and federal governments themselves. It's actually always been like that here, and it wasn't really a huge problem before the advent of the internet. But these days, it means that people are able to turn a profit off of making it easier for other people to get your personal information, and they do. They're called people sites, and if you want to see for yourself, just search your name and address or phone number, and you'll probably come across a bunch of these sites that list at least some of your personal information. But you also have the power to change this. You have the legal right to request that your personal data is removed from each and every one of these sites. The biggest problem is that it takes forever to actually do that. They make it as hard as possible, and you have to do it individually over and over again for every single one of the endless sites that have it. But that's a problem that this video sponsor, Incogni, fixes. They'll do this entire process for you on your behalf. They constantly search through the internet for any of your personal data that's out there. And they'll go through the whole process of taking it all down, including handling any and all rejections. Letting Incogni handle all of this is not only great for peace of mind, but it can also really help cut down on obnoxious spam calls and emails, since it's these very same services that sell your data in bulk. I've been an actual customer of Incogni for years now, so I know that it really works, and I've found the cost to be very well worth it. And it'll be even more worth it for you because Incogni is offering you 60% off of their annual plan when you click the button here on your screen right now, or go to incogni.com/reallifelore or follow the link that's down below in the description and use code REALLIFELORE. It's a great way to help support my channel and the journalism that I'm trying to do here as well. And as always, thank you so much for watching.